This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Today, I want to share just a few issues that are on my mind. I like to talk about things that might not be on your radar, but should be. The first medical condition I'll talk about is sad, scary, and preventable. I'm bringing it to your attention because knowing about this issue might save just one life. And then the second issue I'll talk about is about penises. And even though only about 50% of the population can have issues with them, for some reason, moms seem to care a lot about their sons' penises. I'm going to share the most common concerns that parents ask me about and whether you need to be concerned about this too. Even if you don't have a penis or have a kid, you're going to be interested to hear about parents' concerns about their kids' penises. I'm Dr. Wendy Hunter, and I'm the pediatrician next door. I'm that doctor friend you call for practical advice about your kid's health. I mix the science of medicine with the reality of parenting. Before we get to the lighter side of this episode, I want to share a serious and overlooked issue in kids' health. It's anesthesia for dental procedures. You're either a person who has had anesthesia for a dental procedure, you've had to consider anesthesia for your child, or you wanted to get anesthesia for your kid because getting fillings done can be so uncomfortable. Here's the issue. Dental anesthesia is not always performed by the most qualified person, and there's no way for you to know that. This is not something that is regulated as you would assume. Here's a story that one pediatrician shared about one of their patients. I'm going to read it to you. A 5-year-old patient of our practice who was completely healthy died after going into cardiac arrest from anesthesia at his dental office when he was getting one tooth extracted. It was decayed and had an abscess. I don't know the details of the anesthetic or the procedure. I'm devastated. Why did this happen? I've been researching it for hours. I looked at her pre-op physical clearance note from the clinician that saw her. I traced back her vital signs, her growth chart, and medications. There's nothing, nothing that indicates anything underlying that could have been missed. Her mom called the office to talk to someone to ask how she could have lost her baby to a simple tooth extraction. I've talked about this before, that dental caries is the number one chronic disease of childhood. And when dentists treat cavities, as you know, they sometimes need to put a child to sleep either with light sedation with something like nitrous gas or put them to sleep under general anesthesia. The rules defining who can provide anesthesia have not been well defined until the last few years, and a lot of procedures are still happening in dentists' office without what we pediatricians and anesthesiologists deem are appropriately trained people. Kids are not like adults. I talk about this all the time. We can't put them to sleep like this. That's why there are pediatric specialists, pediatric anesthesiologists. Here's the thing. A child's physiology puts children at greater risk when it comes to anesthesia. Adults have a lot more of what we call an oxygen reserve. They can handle brief periods of low oxygen when they're under anesthesia, whereas most kids can't. Children also have greater metabolic demands for oxygen than adults do. So if they have low oxygen, it can lead to more serious consequences, including brain damage. I and most of my colleagues would argue that a child should only be under deep anesthesia with properly trained people involved. However, each individual state in the United States decides the requirements for licensing and the scope of practice for dental work. A lot of these practitioners, they have a dental assistant help monitor their patient. The American Association of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgeons published guidelines that approved oral surgeons to administer anesthesia with only 2 dental assistants there for support. They justify this practice by saying that one dental assistant's only job is to monitor the patient, while the other one helps the dentist. The oral surgeon in this case is the only person in the room who's trained in anesthesia. And if they're running the procedure, are they really going to notice if a child's not doing well? because it can be subtle. State dental boards do basically nothing to track bad outcomes in dental offices, even though there are a lot of reports that show higher rates of injury and death from anesthesia in dental offices compared with other medical settings. Plus, the level of education and training for dental assistants, it's completely different from state to state. In some states, they often have no more than a high school education, and some of them are only trained on the job in the dental office. These are the people that are putting your child to sleep. In 2019, the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry updated their guidelines for dentists and oral surgeons to follow when they're providing deep sedation or general anesthesia to kids. Their guidelines require that there are always two people in the room who are trained to provide advanced life support measures in case there are problems. One of these people is the dentist or oral surgeon performing the procedure, and the other has to be an independent observer. And that person has to be either a physician anesthesiologist, a certified registered nurse anesthetist, or a second oral surgeon. I gathered the opinions of a whole bunch of my expert friends that I want to share with you here. They had a really good back and forth about this topic. Unfortunately, everyone is at work, so I couldn't record them, but I'm going to read what they all wrote back and forth about this case. Here's what one pediatric anesthesiologist advised. Always, always ask. Parents should only go to places with an anesthesiologist. Ultimately, it's the parent's decision, but it is our job as physicians to guide and provide counsel to our patients. Also, if the kid has recently been sick with something like a normal cold, and if there is any question if he is cleared to have the procedure, especially if it's elective, which is 99% of these cases, don't hesitate to reach out to the group that's providing anesthesia to ask what they think in terms of timing. Like, should you delay? Oftentimes, we have kids cleared by their pediatrician who have recently been sick. Even though their lungs are clear, their airways can still be hyperactive, and kids are more prone to laryngospasm or bronchospasm. This is another point to take into consideration with this case. In my mind, in this post-pandemic era, all kids are sick, always. They are either on the brink of illness or they've recently recovered from one, and you need to adjust your anesthetic accordingly. Small nuances that anyone other than an anesthesiologist might not consider. Here's what another general anesthesiologist said in response. I obviously don't know the details, but I would be willing to bet this was hypoxia, hypoventilation, and apnea going unrecognized for extended periods of time. I cannot say this enough. I don't get paid to treat hypoxia. I get paid to recognize it, and even more, to anticipate it and avoid it altogether. I did not train for all those years to put you to sleep. I trained to wake you up. Every time I hear about one of these cases, I feel sick. No one, especially a five-year-old, should die in a dentist's office. Another anesthesiologist agrees. Here's what she said. I totally agree. Kids desaturate their oxygen really quickly, especially after laryngospasm, which is silent, like drowning. This is so sad. This didn't even have to be a prolonged period of not breathing deeply. It could happen quickly within a minute. A general pediatrician responded to her to clarify what parents should look for. Here's what she asked. What type of anesthesia is appropriate for an office setting versus surgical center? I try to get my patients to request procedures at the surgical center so a trained anesthesiologist will be present, but I know this isn't always possible. And her question got a few responses. Here's one. An anesthesiologist can do sedation or general anesthesia at either a dental office or surgery center. The biggest issue is who is doing the sedation, not where. If there is no doctor anesthesiologist available, only let them use nitrous and a local injected anesthetic. I got more information from anesthesiologists who do dental sedation. Here's what one said. As an anesthesiologist who does IV sedation in an oral surgery office, I would like to add that the vast majority of offices do not carry the drug succinylcholine because of logistics. This is a potentially life-saving drug in case of a severe laryngospasm. Recognizing and preventing laryngospasm is critical in these scenarios, and I do not see how the same person doing the procedure can be acutely and intensely monitoring for this. For my child, no one is sedating with more than a local anesthetic and maybe nitrous without a doctor present. That's when the conversation got a little heated. I appreciated this honest response from a pediatric anesthesiologist and critical care doctor. I would honestly bet my f***ing life savings that this was an unrecognized hypoxic turned cardiac arrest situation. It makes my blood boil. It is preventable. I am absolutely livid. We hear these stories way more often in our anesthesia world since we are more in tune to it, and it is more common than the public, let alone the physician community, thinks. And the last response I got reminds us that not much will change with legislation. One doctor said this: "For everyone that is outraged and wants something to change, start by looking at the rules and regulations regarding sedation and anesthesia in your state. Each state is different, and the rules are set by the dental board. Recognize that the American Dental Association, the dental lobbies, and oral surgeons are very strong. They have been doing sedation and anesthesia for a very long time, mostly safely, with very little oversight. Data is limited and difficult to find. The media is usually where there is any information. Death and significant morbidity happen in adults too, but get less notice and publicity." This is what I noticed too when I was reviewing proposed legislation to set requirements for dental anesthesia. Any bill that was drawn up was heavily opposed by dental organizations. One advocate who has been working to change the laws about this is Dr. Rita Agarwal. She's a clinical professor of anesthesiology at Stanford University. She's been working passionately on this issue, and she sums up the crux of this problem.
So the issue is that, one, state laws are different for sedation and anesthesia in dentistry in every single state. In every single state, they have different requirements and different standards that are followed. So that's one issue, because it's very difficult to apply things across state lines. And some are much, much laxer than California, and some are stricter, but not many. So two, dentistry and particularly oral surgeons practice this unique model that they call, they've steered away because we called it out, the single operator model. They now call it the surgeon operator model, or the surgeon anesthetist model, or the, you know, there's different names for it. But basically, it is a model whereby the surgeon or the dentist does really both the anesthesia and the procedure, whether it's removing wisdom teeth, or, you know, working on dental cleanings and cavities in a kid who has multiple areas that need to be cleaned, or something else. So I just want to repeat that, because there is nowhere else in medicine where this occurs in the same manner, right? Where you have a surgeon or a proceduralist or whoever the main person is doing both the procedure and providing the anesthesia.
Listen, the bottom line is to ask questions and be an advocate for your child if your dentist offers anesthesia for a dental procedure. No child should die because they were getting a cavity filled. And don't feel like you're being a crazy parent if you ask lots of questions and even delay a dental procedure.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
The first story I shared got a little serious, though it's obviously important. So I want to leave you with something a little bit lighter. I don't really know what to say about this topic, except to be super blunt. I spend more time than you would guess talking about penises. I didn't prepare for this in residency. I'm really surprised how many questions I get from parents. I'm actually kind of baffled by it, because I got to be honest, I don't think anyone really cares that much about how a penis looks. Plus, they change a lot over the course of puberty into adulthood. Still, a lot of parents come into my clinic with kids of all ages, and they want to make sure their kid's penis is okay. I will admit this, though. There are a lot of different things that can be wrong with a penis, and even more with the urinary tract. That's why there is not only a specialty of urology, but there is a specialty of pediatric urology. I'm going to talk through a few of the most common concerns that parents have about their son's penis that are normal. The abnormal things are usually picked up at birth. Things like having the urethral opening not located in the correct position at the end of the penis, or absent testicles. Some babies can even have a rotational deformity of their penis. Pediatricians are really careful to examine a baby boy's penis because we know these things need to be fixed. The other thing we look for is something called micropenis, because that can be a sign of a congenital disease or a serious hormone problem. I would guess that most parents who come into my office concerned that their child's penis is too small are worried about the cosmetic look, and they don't even realize that it can be a very significant sign of a bad underlying disease. I talked with pediatric urologist Steve Hodges. He's a urologist at Wake Forest University. We talked about this issue.
The biggest issue we see in penis size referrals is a big kid. You gotta remember that the genitalia don't grow until puberty. But if you have a kid that's grown a lot, like we have these, let's say we have a big chubby 10-year-old that's prepubertal, all his private parts get lost in the shuffle, I say. And so they come in like, they were fine size, it's just he got bigger. And so if you actually see a true micropenis, it's very impactful. It is markedly small. It's less than 2 centimeters on stretch length, and it just looks tiny. And I don't know how to describe it to someone other than I know it when I see it, you know, and it's usually most penises obviously are normal size, and it's just the kid that got bigger. Also, sometimes they kind of tend to recess in the fat pad. A lot of kids have a prepubic fat pad where the penis will sit down in it. And so if you can push the fat out of the way, a lot of times you'll expose a normal-sized penis. You've seen a lot of ears or whatever, right, inside the ears. So you know, like, immediately is it infected or not. I've seen a lot of penises. I know just from a gestalt, okay, that's a normal size. And it's not just the length. The glands is really tiny in micropenis. It all looks really tiny. So I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It's just super rare. Most cases, if you just look at it and it looks about average, then they're fine.
The other question I get very often is about whether the doctor took off enough foreskin when the child was circumcised. Sometimes they could have taken off more. When the child goes through puberty, though, it's exposed to a bunch of hormones and the penis changes a lot and the foreskin tends to stretch out and not be so excessive. And in kids who weren't circumcised, parents ask if they need to retract the foreskin. Here's what Dr. Hodges suggests.
The other thing is the foreskin. If the child's not circumcised, the foreskin does not come back until puberty a lot of times. I always mention there was a study in, I think it was Netherlands, where they just followed kids with uncircumcised foreskin and didn't bother the foreskin at all. And they recorded when the skin was fully retractile. And the last kid was 17 years old. So at 17, the skin came back. And so I do see a lot of consults where the dad doesn't remember. He just knows that he has a retractile foreskin now and he wonders why his 2-month-old or 2-year-old doesn't have retractile foreskin. And so you shouldn't force it back. And people overclean the penis, I think. They try to really get underneath there. And if the skin is fused, you can't separate it. So that's definitely the issues we see with foreskin.
One of the more common foreskin issues we do see in clinic that maybe needs some treatment is called balanitis. That's irritation or inflammation of the head of the penis. How do you handle that?
I think that most cases I see are kids with a lot of foreskin where when they void, again, I just finished saying don't retract the foreskin, but you don't want to let it hang loose. So when they void, you're kind of letting urine sit in the internal side of the foreskin. So they should retract the foreskin as far as it goes. So it's tight up against the head. So when they void, there's less space to fill and retain urine, if that makes sense. Because I think urine sitting in there leads to inflammation and balanitis. And then when it happens, you know, we can just treat it with steroid cream and sitz baths. And you can obviously do a circumcision if you want to.
Oh, so you don't need to use antibiotic ointment?
I don't. I just use steroid and sitz baths. You can, but I've not used it and done fine.
So when you potty train an uncircumcised boy, should you teach him to gently retract his foreskin when he's peeing?
Yeah, I have them hold it as they aim it to pull it back till it stops going easily. And that way it's kind of flush up against the head and then there's nowhere else for the urine to go but out.
That's one potty training tip that I didn't talk about in episode 48, my episode about mastering the potty. Finally, I asked Dr. Hodges if there were any other issues that are referred to his clinic, maybe things that I don't see in primary care, but he sees because they're referred to him.
Oh, another thing, boys a lot of time will just start grabbing at it and they ask me, why is he doing that? And the penis is completely normal. I'm like, I don't know. The penis looks fine. I just know it's a very common behavior. And they'll really yank at it. Like you think they're going to rip it off. And I just cover that thing up. I say, put the diaper on and keep them away from it.
Parents do bring their kids in for an evaluation because they're pulling on their penis very aggressively. If Dr. Hodges and I both see this, I don't think there's any pathology here. From a developmental perspective, we're talking about kids who don't get embarrassed. They don't know they're not supposed to pull on their privates, and they just found a really crazy piece of their body and don't have enough frontal lobe development or coordination to be gentle. Around 9 months, kids tend to pull like this on their ears, you know? I also have a fair number of patients who take off their diaper and like to walk around holding their penis. Don't stress about this. If you've been listening to this show for a while, you may remember there was a parent who contacted me because her daughter was masturbating during nap time at preschool. This kind of behavior is really common, and it's nothing to worry about. If you want to hear my advice on that one, check out episode 4. I cover bedwetting and dealing with super chapped lips in that episode too. Speaking of bedwetting, one more plug for the brilliant Dr. Steve Hodges. His expertise as a urologist is on bedwetting and constipation, and you can find his very effective bedwetting program at bedwettingandaccidents.com. I'll put the link in the show notes. I want to leave you with one last thought from Dr. Hodges because this really resonated with me.
My favorite line is, I don't know what it's supposed to look like. It just doesn't look normal.
If you ever think something isn't quite normal and you want me to cover it, let me know. You can find me at drwendyhunter.com. For more from the Pediatrician Next Door, find me on the web at pediatriciannextdoorpodcast.com. If you've got a question about the weird things kids do, send an email to hello@pediatriciannextdoorpodcast.com for a chance to hear your voice on the show. I'm Dr. Wendy Hunter, and I'm the Pediatrician Next Door. This show is produced by Red Rock Music. Make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever it is you're listening. I'll be back next time with more.